cultivated land, supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we take a look at fake news. Is it a Trojan horse for silencing alternative news to reestablish corporate news dominance? We're joined by researcher and author Emil Marmel, who has a chapter in the new Censored 2020 book that examines this very question. Later in the program, we'll be joined by independent journalist Minar Mahawish at Mint Press News to talk about social media censorship. Stay with us.
By criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we look at fake news, the Trojan horse for silencing alternative news and reestablishing corporate news dominance. On the program today, we welcome author and researcher Emil Marmel. Emil wrote this chapter with Lee Major for Censored 2020 Through the Looking Glass. Emil Marmel is a PhD candidate at the University of Toronto, Ontario Institute for Studies in Education. As an interdisciplinary scholar with experience in professional film and radio production, Emil has published on critical media literacy, Cuban society, the impact of neoliberalism on higher education, repression of Latina and Latinos in education, standardized testing, labor struggles, and film. Emil is currently writing his doctoral thesis as an autoethnography testimonial about growing up as the son of Latino immigrants in Orange County, California. But on today's program, we're going to learn about Emil Marmel's research interests around critical media literacy and, of course, what led him to write this chapter for Censored 2020. Emil Marmel, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Mickey, thank you so much for having me on.
It is a delight to have you, Emil. This is an absolutely fantastic chapter in our newest book, Censored 2020 Through the Looking Glass, that we edited with Andy Lee Roth. Given that we've been inundated with the term fake news for a few years now, we need to be very careful, of course, out front to say fake news is in fact nothing new. It's propaganda. It's disinformation. It's misinformation. And in light of this so-called spate of fake news in our so-called post-truth world that relies on alternative facts to buttress these establishment narratives, you call in your chapter that this effort of the establishment now to fight fake news, the very groups that are responsible for peddling it are now saying that they're going to fight it. And in the process, what that means is they're trying to silence alternative news and reestablish corporate news dominance. So, Emil Marmel, talk to us about, you know, what led you to this research and gives you the background to write about this very significant topic right now.
I became interested in critical media literacy many years ago when a good friend handed me a copy of Manufacturing Consent. And then I wrote my master's thesis on network neutrality and the importance of protecting it, because I saw that communications firms wanted to privatize and control the internet. Unfortunately, they've succeeded to an extent in eliminating network neutrality. The battle continues. But censorship is something that has interested me for many years now. And I am particularly keen on alternative news because you get viewpoints, angles, information, context that you won't get in the corporate media. In fact, I try to stay clear of corporate media because I actually like to be informed and not misinformed. And so after the election, I initially started seeing reports of censorship coming up on the World Socialist website. And as soon as I saw that happen, my ears perked up. And I thought, okay, time to really start digging in on this. And to take a step back, I think it's important to look at the foundation of this whole thing that's happened. The United States, particularly under Obama, has taken a hard anti-Russian stance. All of a sudden, the Russians are everywhere and they're perpetuating horrific crimes against the world in every single place. And I cited in my chapter a bunch of different purported crimes that the Russians have been guilty of. One of them, my favorites, because it's just, like so many of them, absurd on its face, is the Russia training whales to harass Norwegian fishermen. And it doesn't end. There's a Washington Post article titled, "Even one of Trump's favorite foods has a hidden Russia connection." And a quote from the article is, "Like so much about this current administration, even Trump's beloved hamburgers have surprising ties to Russia." Or, for instance, Kamala Harris has said publicly, "Remember Bend the Knee and Colin Kaepernick? It was actually not a thing. The Russian bots started taking that over." And then Clinton has claimed recently, without a shred of evidence, that Jill Stein and Tulsi Gabbard are Russian assets. And the fact that public officials can get away with saying such things and that they're not mocked and have to disappear from public view for their absurdities is a sign of corporate media power. If you repeat a lie over and over again, the public will believe it because no alternative explanations are offered. So all of this Russia bashing and conspiracy has been used to put the public in a compliant state of fear. And that's why I begin the chapter with the Hermann Göring quote, in which he describes how you can manipulate the public by convincing them that they're being attacked. You know, it's just like the Iraq weapons of mass destruction lie that was perpetrated on the public to justify going to war with that country, destroying that country. So what the Democratic Party and the corporate media did after the election was to manufacture this completely farcical narrative that the Russians had colluded with Trump to hand him the election. And this, of course, was the ultimate insult. It's actually something that didn't happen. But I think the most important thing to do is to have people understand and realize the magnitude of the conspiracy they are being asked to believe and to totally discredit it. So I'd like to talk about that.
I'm glad you're bringing that up, especially because with these so-called impeachment inquiries and hearings, we've recently seen Fiona Hill resurrect the Russiagate thesis. And again, let's be clear. There is evidence that the Kremlin or that Putin or that Russians or that Russian intel does have an interest, of course, in what's going on in U.S. politics. That shouldn't be a surprise to anyone. There is evidence, of course, that we've seen some interference in elections from Russia over the years, but nowhere near, by the way, I want to make sure we point this out, and of course, Emil, you know this, the United States actually has interfered scores of times in other countries' elections, including in Russia's back in the 1990s. And again, are there criminal elements in the Trump administration? Yes. Does Trump have some shady dealings with certain Russian bankers or oligarchs or people around him? Well, we've seen some of that has been proven. But the main thesis that the Kremlin handed Trump the election has not been proven by any metric. And the fact that Ukrainegate has now like basically picked up the baton where the Mueller report and testimony seem to have failed is evidence that the corporate media and the corporate-backed Democratic Party are just going to keep flogging this horse. And speaking of Trojan horses, they're going to keep flogging it all the way through the 2020 election. And I'm fearful that this may backfire spectacularly as they don't get bombshell moments like they think they're getting. You said you think it's a very important thing for people to realize the magnitude of what's happening behind all of this. Talk a little bit about why we need to debunk this.
There is an organization called the Internet Research Agency, the IRA, and they did put out messaging before and after the election. However, as far as I know, there have been no links established that prove that the Kremlin and IRA were in this together. The IRA did put out a total of $100,000 in ads, but only 46,000 of that was put out before the election. The remainder, the 54,000, was spent after the election. And there's a lot of, again, facts and figures in the chapter, but one that sticks out in my mind is something put out by Consortium News that between 2015 and 17, Facebook logged a total of 33 trillion posts. During that same time, the IRA accounted for 80,000 of those. I mean, that's not even a drop in the bucket. It's practically non-existent. But also, when you look at the money spent, to put it into perspective, the Trump and Clinton campaigns spent $81 million on Facebook ads alone. And overall, $2.4 billion was spent on just the presidential election alone. And beyond that, the IRA posts barely even mentioned the election. Only 11% of the posts were election-related. And even less of those, only 7% of Facebook posts and 6% of tweets mentioned either candidate by name. And then again, the IRA posts were absurd and ridiculous in nature. This is the case even for the few that had anything to do with the election. For instance, there's one that I showed at an academic conference that had a buff, like muscular Bernie Sanders pointing off into the distance. and it was a color by numbers graphic. Like, this is just stuff that is comical. And this ad is something I had to look up because I never saw any of these posts by the IRA myself. So to continue on with what has happened with all of this Russiagate and anti-Russia hysteria, what they've done with all of this is to harness it to silence and censor dissident and counter-hegemonic news and views online. One of the first big events that happened was in April of 2017 as part of an initiative called Project Owl. Google changed its algorithm to supposedly fight fake news and surface more, quote, authoritative content. They've also hired 10,000 of what they call, quote, search quality raters to assist in their censorship process. Now, what Google views as prioritizing more authoritative content is actually silencing alternative media. So what's happened is they're censoring the alternative press. The changes they've implemented have caused a precipitous decline in traffic for some of the most popular and trusted alternative news sources online, such as Common Dreams, Consortium News, Counterpunch, Democracy Now!, Global Research, Media Matters for America, Mint Press News, Truthout, Truthdig, WikiLeaks, and the World Socialist Website.
I just want to interject here very briefly. That list that you just rattled off, I couldn't help but notice that not only are those all non-corporate sources of information, they're all progressive or left-leaning or anti-establishment. And of course, you mentioned the World Socialist Website or WikiLeaks, which give us this raw data and information that the corporate media want to curate, keep out of the minds of the American public. So it's interesting that these search quality raters seem to have a problem with a very particular kind of narrative that counters the top-down establishment one coming through the government and through the establishment press.
Yes, that's true. They're not censoring any of their corporate press partners. It's just the alternative press, and it's mostly the leftist press or the dissident press, those that take issue with establishment views. And I just gave an example of a few alternative news sites. That's just a tiny sampling. I mean, this is affecting a broad spectrum of leftist anti-establishment news websites.
Including libertarians and some further on the right. So again, it's not just on the left. That should be noted. And it's also the case then, like you said, we don't see these people rating false stories in the New York Times and the Washington Post, of which there are many. I want to remind our listeners that you're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We are speaking with researcher Emil Marmol. He is the co-author of a fantastic chapter in our new book, Censored 2020, Through the Looking Glass. And we're going through the looking glass right now and down the rabbit hole with Alice to talk about fake news, the Trojan horse for silencing alternative news and reestablishing corporate news dominance. We'll continue our conversation with Emil Marmol after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, and particularly in this segment, we're talking about fake news. Of course, we know that that's nothing new. It's propaganda and disinformation. But we're talking about it as it regards a chapter of the new Censored 2020 book, The Trojan Horse for Silencing Alternative News and Reestablishing Corporate News Dominance. We are joined by author and researcher Emil Marmol. Emil, let's talk about what's going on these major tech platforms, because big tech and social media are now rivaling in many ways the legacy media for attention. Some 40% of Americans say that they get their, quote, news from social media. Of course, we know that internet giant Alphabet, parent company of Google, has algorithms and things that spike sources and literally censor them. So let's pick up there and continue the conversation, talking more about that angle.
You've got all these alternative news websites putting out articles saying that their content is being held back. It's not showing up in search results. They've got less visitors. I mean, this has all come as a direct result of Google's new algorithms. But you don't have to take the word of these alternative news websites. You don't have to take my word. You could just listen to Google themselves. There is a leaked internal document from Google, and it is titled The Good Censor. It's a document from inside their company that lays out their strategy and position as a controller and censor of online information. They claim that due to Russian involvement in the 2016 election, that they must censor online content. They offer some other reasons too. You know, for instance, they want to protect advertisers from controversial content and increase revenues. They also argue that they must censor content because the public in general behaves badly. So I guess Google, they want to act as our parents. They want to protect us from ourselves, so to speak. It is clear from Google's own internal documents that they are doing that.
And of course, fake news and propaganda as disinformation is a problem. But the way in which these folks are using it is like a Trojan horse. Who's being censored and who's doing this censoring?
It's Google, it's Facebook, it's Twitter, and it's their partnered organizations, and we can get into that.
It's the partnered organizations upon which they rely that have extraordinary connections, not just connections to government and the establishment. They are the military-industrial complex. They are the national security technology complex. So tell us about that, Emil.
I'm just going to scratch the surface here. There's so much in the chapter that I cannot speak to here because of time constraints. But let's just talk about the major players. One of them is the Atlantic Council, which is essentially an arm of NATO. They are funded by Western governments, NATO itself, major weapons manufacturers, international banks, conservative think tanks, the National Endowment for Democracy, among others. And on its board, you will find figures with exceedingly undemocratic worldviews, such as Michael Chertoff, Condoleezza Rice, Michael Hayden, Madeleine Albright, and Henry Kissinger. And for anybody who knows political issues, they would know that Madeleine Albright and Henry Kissinger in particular are all of these people, but those two last ones particularly are heinous war criminals, especially Henry Kissinger. You know, people who you don't associate with democratic values. And another couple of organizations with which the social media giants have partnered are the International Republican Institute and the National Democratic Institute. Both of these are offshoots of the National Endowment for Democracy, or NED. Now, the NED, people should know, was created during the Reagan administration with the explicit purpose of spreading propaganda and interfering with the internal affairs of other countries. And to just continue on with the International Republican Institute, on their board sits Marco Rubio. He has played a leading role in the U.S.-led coup, or at least attempted coup for now, against Venezuela. And the former chairperson of the IRI was Senator John McCain. John McCain was a politician who wanted to bomb every country he could. And then for the NDI, the National Democratic Institute, their current chairperson is Madeleine Albright, who stated that the deaths of 500,000 Iraqi children due to U.S. sanctions was worth it. That's not a person I would trust to watch my dog. So in addition to partnering with these organizations, Facebook itself, like Google, has hired over 30,000 fact checkers. And these include many former intelligence and law enforcement officials, as well as prosecutors who worked in counterterrorism. And going back to what you were saying about all of this being part of the military-industrial complex and ruling elites, let's look at those people who have leadership positions at Facebook. What they are is an extension of state power. You've got Nathaniel Gleicher. He was Obama's National Security Council Director for Cybersecurity. You have Jennifer Newstead, who was co-author of the USA Patriot Act, a fundamentally undemocratic piece of policy. Then you've got Joel Kaplan, who was the White House Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy under George W. Bush. And then you've got Nick Clegg, the former British Deputy Prime Minister. I had a friend read my chapter, and she said, Jesus, Emil, after reading your chapter, it's become abundantly clear to me that you think that there's a rotation, there are different people in charge pulling the strings, and that things work in fundamentally democratic ways. But she said, I look at your chapter, and I see these same people from the Bush administration, Obama administration, still pulling all the strings. And again, if you read the chapter, you'll see how intricate all these links and how deep they are between all these organizations. And it is rather frightening to see how these social media organizations and tech firms like Google are simply extensions of the state.
Which is curious because, again, when we talk about First Amendment protections, one of the things that critics will say about that is, well, that's about the government. The government isn't allowed to interfere in the free press or in free speech issues. But as we've showed time and again, and as you're illustrating again right now, these corporations, these massive corporations, multinationals, they're an extension of the state very clearly. I'd like to hear a little bit more about the cyber warfare arm of U.S. foreign policy as it is manifest through Facebook and Twitter. Could you talk about that, Emil?
Yeah, sure. I do want to mention that it's serving two purposes. It's serving to silence domestic-based dissent. For instance, on October 11, 2018, more than 800 accounts were deleted or deplatformed on Facebook and Twitter. And in this purge were many organizations that were against, for instance, police brutality and war and criticized U.S. domestic and foreign policy. I mean, these sites had, I believe it was in the tens of millions of subscribers and viewers. But now going to the cyber warfare aspect of these organizations, what they're doing is they're targeting specifically countries to which the U.S. is hostile towards. So when you look at the chapter, you'll see that they have censored the leaders, political parties, activists, and media outlets of countries the U.S. is hostile towards. So this includes Venezuela, Iran, Palestine. Not only are they censoring news organizations, politicians, activists out of those countries, but they're also silencing alternative news sources that defend the positions of those countries. So for instance, Venezuela Analysis.
Telesur is next.
Yeah, they've already been removed twice. But what happens is there's an outcry, and then the social media giants have no choice but to go back and reinstate it. So this is a back and forth game. The social media giants are thinking, let's deplatform these, let's censor these, let's see what we can get away with. I've got many bullet points in the chapter that talk about specific instances of censoring and deplatforming. But, you know, it's not always even countries that the U.S. is hostile towards that get the censorship stick. One that I found was shocking and frightening. Days before the Spanish general election, Facebook-owned WhatsApp shut down the channel of Podemos, one of Spain's leftist political parties. The channel had 50,000 members. What is Facebook doing, shutting down a channel used by a political party in Spain?
Talking about interfering in elections.
Exactly. The hypocrisy is so thick that anybody who really delves deeply into this will just, I think, be blown away.
So, Emil Marmol, I wanted to get into one of the cyber warfare arms of U.S. foreign policy as it's manifest in an organization that we've talked about on this program, and you talk about it in your chapter. One of these adjunct organizations is called NewsGuard. Could you talk to a little bit about how that's working? Because this is a perfect example of an organization that is claiming to fight fake news and claiming to, in parental fashion, put some controls on us for our own good because we can't think for ourselves. What's NewsGuard's approach?
NewsGuard, I started reading about them before traveling to an academic conference on critical media literacy education. And when I got to the conference and saw that they were one of the vendors there, I nearly lost my mind. That's what they're posing as, an organization that's going to help shield us, protect us from fake news and misinformation. But looking at NewsGuard, what they're doing is they've released a web browser plugin that flags trustworthy news with a green icon and untrustworthy sites with a red icon. So what NewsGuard does, for instance, is they give WikiLeaks, Russia Today, and Mint Press News all red ratings. And I will say that Mint Press News is a fantastic alternative news website. Russia Today, even if you disagree with it, it's a great news website. And of course, WikiLeaks should be applauded for all that they've done to expose the machinations of Western governments and political and economic elites. But here's the rub. What they do is they give Fox News and Voice of America green ratings. Fox News and Voice of America are propaganda outlets. They're essentially arms of U.S. propaganda. Fox News has been largely discredited by academics as not even as deserving the title of a news organization. And Voice of America was created to propagate U.S. propaganda. Meanwhile, the corporate media has done nothing but heap praise on this organization, of course, because they're eliminating competing narratives. And it helps, once again, to look at who sits on advisory boards and boards of directors. So let's have a quick look at NewsGuard. It includes Michael Hayden, Tom Ridge, and Richard Stengel. Michael Hayden is the former head of the CIA and NSA, and Tom Ridge was the first director of the Department of Homeland Security. You might wonder why they have red and green ratings. Well, that's the same thing that the Department of Homeland Security did to keep people in a compliant state of fear, is keep telling them, oh man, we're in this red rating and we're going to get attacked. Then you've got Richard Stengel, and I'd like to focus on him, because it's particularly revealing that Richard Stengel is also on their board of advisors. He is former editor of Time magazine. He worked in the Obama administration and is a distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensics Lab.
Historic Cold War echoes of Henry Luce, but at any rate, please continue.
For sure, yeah. Again, particularly illustrative is a quote made by Stengel at a public forum. He says, quote, "My old job at the State Department was what people used to call the chief propagandist job. I'm not against propaganda. Every country does it, and they have to do it to their own population, and I don't necessarily think it's awful." So here you have Stengel, who's working for NewsGuard, claiming to be an organization that fights fake news and misinformation. Meanwhile, Stengel himself, he's a self-declared propagandist. And he thinks it's okay to disseminate propaganda on domestic populations. So how does that work? How do you reconcile those two things? You can't. It's just straight up hypocrisy. It's what it is. It's just an organization working to silence alternative news and dissident content.
That's pretty amazing. And then, of course, you also talk about the people who are co-CEO over at NewsGuard.
You've got the co-CEO. His name is Lewis Gordon Krovitz, or Krovitz. He has an appalling record as a journalist for spreading misinformation and falsehoods. You know, he wrote a couple of pieces, something I believe it was about the NSA and the beginnings of the internet, and those have been largely debunked and criticized as just completely missing the mark and being full of misinformation. So everybody at that organization is amongst the least qualified people to be defending us against fake news and misinformation.
And curiously, you know, NewsGuard gives some of these other organizations like WikiLeaks or RT or Mint Press red ratings, and somehow Fox and MSNBC and the rest get great green ratings. The whole thing is like a ruse, and as you say in the subtitle of the chapter, it's a Trojan horse for establishment news dominance. This is basically a way that they're using to prop up the manufacturers of consent. So tell us a little bit more about that, Emil Marmol.
It's two purposes they're after. First, silence the alternative news, silence dissent, silence counter-hegemonic content. But the other end of the game is propping up the corporate news media. And so you've got social media firms, tech giants, the corporate media itself, and the government working to prop up the corporate media. And examples of this are, for instance, the Google News Initiative. That's a partnership between Google, the Financial Times, Gannett, the New York Times, the Washington Post, Stanford University, the Poynter Institute, and many other organizations. It's a $300 million project that aims to stem the tide of what these companies regard as fake news, disinformation, and misinformation, and to promote trustworthy and authoritative, always bringing that up, authoritative content. Then you've got Report for America and Google News Lab. They're working in conjunction to hire more than 1,000 journalists all over the states. Google's the one who's doling out most of the money for that project. And again, looking at the advisory board for the RFA, the Report for America, who do you see there? You see Charles Koch Institute, you see Fox News, you see CBS News, ABC News, the Wall Street Journal, NPR, Twitter, and the New York Times. You don't see anybody from an alternative news website or source on that advisory board. And then Facebook's doing its own part. They've set aside $90 million to produce trustworthy and informative news programming in collaboration with corporate news giants Fox News. That alone is enough. CNN, ABC News, and Univision. And of those, Facebook is giving preferential treatment to Fox News, which is the only network to have a show featured on Watch every day of the week. So apparently Facebook thinks that Fox News is so trustworthy that they need to be front and center. And of course, ad revenues will be shared amongst the participating organizations. And you just recently did a show with Andy Lee Roth, where you talk about Facebook has cemented even further agreements with corporate media firms to co-create news content. So they're further solidifying those ties and working together to prop up the corporate media. And meanwhile, doing everything they can to smother alternative news.
So, Emil Marmol, we're pretty much out of time for this segment of the program, but you've given us an awful lot to think about, our listeners, and we're very grateful for the research that you have done. Emil Marmol is a PhD candidate at the University of Toronto, Ontario Institute for Studies and Education. And Emil Marmol with Lee Major have a chapter in the new Project Censored book, Censored 2020. Through the Looking Glass, the chapter is titled Fake News, the Trojan Horse for Silencing Alternative News and Reestablishing Corporate News Dominance. I encourage listeners to pay attention to the projectcensored.org site because we'll be sharing some more of Emil's work and some updates on this research very soon. Emil Marmol, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to share this research with our audience.
Mickey, I'm delighted to have been on the show.
I'd like to remind listeners, you're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On the next segment of the program, we continue our theme. We'll be rejoined from a journalistic perspective by Manar Mahawesh of Mint Press News to talk about social media censorship reaching new heights as Twitter permanently bans dissent. Stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we welcome back the founder and editor-in-chief of Mint Press News, Manar Mahawesh. Manar Mahawesh, of course, is no stranger to the Project Censored audience. Many of the people that work with Mint Press News and do stellar independent journalism have had stories in the annual Censored books. This year's book is no different. Censored 2020. We also, of course, have an entire chapter in this year's book about today's topic, fake news, the Trojan horse for silencing alternative news and reestablishing corporate news dominance. Manar Mahawesh, you have written a lot about censorship, deplatforming. You've covered a lot of this at mintpressnews.com. And we wanted to have you on the program today just to get some updates. And I know recently you've done some stellar interviews with folks that have been really following this issue very closely. And again, I want to make sure that listeners can go and read your reports and look at your broadcasts that you do. But what I wanted to do, welcoming you back to the show, is to reintroduce some of this issue to our audience. It's no open secret, you write, that the deep state's working hand in hand with Silicon Valley social media giants like Twitter, Facebook, and Google to control the flow of information, and that includes suppressing, censoring, and sometimes outright purging dissenting voices, all under the guise of fighting fake news and Russian propaganda. So, Manar Mahawesh, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
It's always good to hear from you. You have been consistently covering this story. In fact, you're one of the few journalists that's been consistently covering this story. And by the way, a lot of the other folks that we've had on have ended up doing reporting with Mint Press News about this very topic. So could you tell us a little bit about what's happening in this kind of deplatforming and this kind of censorship online?
Well, as you know, since the 2016 presidential election between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, social media tech giants like Twitter, Facebook, and Google have basically gone on a rampage of purging and censoring and suppressing dissenting voices, all under the guise of fighting fake news and Russian propaganda. And the most recent example was this bombshell that was released that showed that Twitter's senior editorial executive for Europe, the Middle East, and Africa is actually an active officer in the British Army's 77th Brigade, and it's a unit dedicated to online warfare and psychological operations. And so what that really means is that this guy leading this arm of Twitter, he specializes in disseminating propaganda. And so it's no secret, and it makes sense as to how we have these deep state people, whether it's in our government or the British government or NATO government, are working hand in hand with social media tech giants to control the free flow of information. And I did this report just in the last couple of weeks here. I interviewed Daniel McAdams. He's the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace. It's no secret that this organization, they promote peace, and then they call out U.S. empire. And Daniel McAdams specifically has done an excellent, excellent job of bringing attention to neocons that have basically, he calls it, occupied the White House. And he went on Twitter to call out Fox Sean Hannity for wearing a CIA lapel pin while doing an hour-long segment calling out the CIA. And he basically called him retarded on Twitter. Jeez. And because of that one statement, he got banned from Twitter forever. He was purged. He was removed. He was deleted off of Twitter.
Minar, I'm sorry to interrupt. Is that because of the language that he used?
They banned him. They deplatformed him. They said that he used hateful conduct because he used the term retarded, but actually it just takes 2 seconds to look at all of the comments underneath President Trump's tweets to see even more hateful commentary than that. And Daniel McAdams, he's been on Twitter, very outspoken, very popular following on his page, calling out neocons, calling out the deep state. And so I believe, and he believes, that that was why he was targeted and eventually removed off of Twitter. And not just him as a journalist. I mean, his background, again, it's in journalism, it's in politics. He advised former presidential candidate Ron Paul, you know, libertarian presidential candidate Ron Paul. But then we have Twitter and Facebook also working hand in hand with the Israeli government to completely delete Palestinian news pages. Just completely delete them off of those platforms. The Israeli Justice Minister proudly announced that Facebook abided to 95% of their requests to Facebook to remove and delete Palestinian pages. So it's very clear that these social media platforms, which once touted themselves as being platforms for all ideas are welcome, are now working very directly with authoritarian governments from Israel, Saudi Arabia, think tanks like the NATO-funded Atlantic Council, to the British Army to delete pages and remove dissenting voices.
And it also sounds like there is a serious selective decision-making going on among these social media tech giants, because obviously anybody that scrolls down the Twitter feeds of people like Donald Trump or Ann Coulter or Jeanine Pirro or Hannity or others and their followers, there's no shortage of hatred going on there, not to mention the clownish activity of a Sean Hannity wearing a CIA lapel pin while doing a segment on that. And is that supposed to be a nod and a wink? Hannity, of course, listeners of this show may know, and we wrote about this, Nolan Higdon and I, in United States of Distraction, Hannity actually went on the campaign trail with Donald Trump around the midterm elections, saying that at Fox News, he wouldn't go on and campaign with anybody. And then a day later, Hannity was on stage campaigning with Donald Trump, and he was calling out the so-called fake news in the back of the room they were in, not realizing that Fox News was back there. Now, this is amazing. Of course, there were no punishments that went on for this, but even the Fox News executives said that Hannity stepped over a line. And for them, that, I mean, I know we're setting the bar pretty low here, but even for them to say that you can't have on-air journalistic personalities hopping on the campaign trail, which Hannity does, which Pirro does, which clearly puts them in the light that they are rank propagandists. They're not broadcast journalists. Yes. They're not anchors. They're stenographers for what people are putting in front of them. They're rank ideologues. Interestingly enough, though, those people are all over the airwaves and all over social media. And it's interesting that those people that want to call it out and those people that want to report the things that you're reporting at Mint Press News find themselves curiously deplatformed. So what are your thoughts about that?
Well, there's clearly a set of rules for those in the establishment, that those that work in the interest of U.S. empire and the deep state, and rules that apply to us, independent journalists or dissenting voices. We have people like Marco Rubio threatening Nicolas Maduro a few months ago with like assassination, with death. And we have Donald Trump threatening entire nations with nuclear annihilation. You have other politicians threatening other things. Yet they are allowed to say those things without any consequences. But then if you, Mickey Huff, or me, or Daniel McAdams goes on Twitter or Facebook to call out the hypocrisy and to call out violence and to say, you know, we need to have a non-interventionist foreign policy, oh my gosh, we get deplatformed. And that's really, really scary for freedom of speech and our First Amendment.
Yeah, and Manar Mahawish at Mint Press News, at your article, and I again encourage our listeners to go and read some of these articles here. Particularly, there's one where you have your recent interview with Daniel McAdams. It's titled, Social Media Censorship Reaches New Heights as Twitter Permanently Bans Dissent. So that's at mintpressnews.com. We've, of course, had Alan McLeod on. We've had Whitney Webb on. So again, our listeners shouldn't be strangers to some of the great journalists that work with you over at Mint Press News. But you've been, again, like I said, you've been talking about this issue for quite some time. Of course, Abby Martin has and many others. The reason that we keep hitting on this at the Project Censored show, and you point this out in your article accompanying the broadcast, the interview that you did with McAdams, 39% of Americans and similar numbers of people in other countries get their news from Facebook. That's pretty troubling, but putting that aside momentarily, you write, when an organization like the Atlantic Council is controlling what the world sees in their Facebook news feeds, it can only be described to state censorship on a global level, given the ties of the Atlantic Council to NATO. And you even remind us of who's who at the Atlantic Council. We've got Henry Kissinger, Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, James Baker, Michael Chertoff, you know, from the Patriot Act and Homeland Security days, a lot of Army generals like David Petraeus, etc., Michael Hayden, Leon Panetta. It's a laundry list of deep state characters. You call it a rogues gallery of warmongers. But it's kind of interesting that you also include in this, and, you know, and again, for people to not think that that's just some kind of screed, you actually also quote Eric Schmidt and Google executive Jared Cohen in their own book. They said, quote, what Lockheed Martin was to the 20th century, or that's the big defense manufacturer, what Lockheed Martin was to the 20th century, technology and cybersecurity companies like Google will be to the 21st. So, Manar Mahawish, right, here they are basically admitting that they're going to be curating and censoring, no?
They admit it, and that's why I started out this article with, it's an open secret, because it's really out and open. It's not a secret anymore. They're proud of it. They come out regularly and make these statements. And the Atlantic Council, for example, the fact that the Atlantic Council, one of the most hawkish neoconservative think tanks in Washington, D.C., is partnering with Facebook, that should be a huge red flag for every social media consumer out there. I mean, it really raises the question why an organization that is largely funded by weapons manufacturers, by apartheid Israel, by an autocratic regime like Saudi Arabia, and Democrats that are very much aligned with Hillary Clinton and her hawkish foreign policy worldview. And then again, Bush-era neocons that you mentioned, this should really concern news consumers and social media consumers to a point where they realize that what they're getting in their news feed is 100% controlled. We are seeing things in our news feed that are coming from BuzzFeed, you know, a lot of the neoliberal supported organizations like BuzzFeed, like Vice News, and other corporate media outlets. They're able to reach millions of followers, while independent and alternative media outlets who may have hundreds of thousands of followers are struggling, purposely struggling by Facebook because of their algorithms directed at us. They're struggling to reach their own followers. Sometimes they can only reach like a couple of percentages of their followers. One example of something that Facebook has cracked down upon are images of skeletal children in Yemen. And we believe that's because of Facebook's partnership with the Atlantic Council, which is, again, largely funded by Saudi Arabia and influenced by Saudi Arabia and weapons manufacturers. I mean, the war in Yemen, which is the world's worst humanitarian crisis, is also one of the most profitable wars of this era. And so to show these images of children starving at the hands of Saudi Arabia and the United States backing of this blockade and bombardment of Yemen's agriculture, food supply, and just blocking all humanitarian aid and food from entering, that would really reach the heartstrings of people around the world. But we can barely access those photos on social media because Facebook, what they've done is they've been flagging them and removing them, saying that they don't meet their community standards of providing a positive environment for users. And I know this for a fact because our documentary about Yemen's starving population was denied ads specifically for that reason. We were sent a message by Facebook to say that because of the images of the children, it doesn't meet our standards for a positive environment. Yet we have politicians pushing homophobia, Islamophobia, xenophobia, anti-Semitism, promoting hate every single day, and they're allowed to speak but have their pages not removed from Facebook.
That's the voice of Manar Mahawish, founder and editor-in-chief of Mint Press News. After this brief musical break, I'm going to continue our conversation about social media censorship and online censorship with Manar Mahawish. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's programs, we revisit yet another time the topic of internet and social media censorship. My guest for this segment of the program is Manar Mahawish, who is the founder and editor-in-chief of Mint Press News. She is a regular speaker on responsible journalism, sexism, neoconservatism within the media and journalism startups, and has for some time been a consistent voice speaking out against social media deplatforming and online censorship. And so, Manar Mahawish, I want to continue that conversation because we have seen not only that going on with what's taking place in Yemen and Palestine, and of course, again, you're certainly not the only one to be on the receiving end of censorship surrounding that issue. You included Electronic Intifada's Ali Abu Nima, right, who was talking about censorship, who actually called the Twitter purging of Palestinian news pages. He said, quote, "This alarming act of censorship is another indication of the complicity of major social media firms in Israel's efforts to suppress news and information about its abuses of Palestinian rights." Manar Mahawish, it's unfortunate, but this is something that's also taking place in the political changes, the coup d'etats in South America from Venezuela to Bolivia. I know you have been following what's going on, particularly in Bolivia, so if you can shed some light on that topic as it relates to social media censorship here.
Apart from social media censorship, we can begin by talking about the lack of information and proper information and truthful information that's coming out by our corporate media right now and covering what's happening in Bolivia. The media, the corporate media, and a lot of international human rights organizations like that of Human Rights Watch are working in step with the Trump administration in smearing democratically elected President Evo Morales, calling him a strong man, supporting the coup, and not even calling it a coup, obviously, even though it is a military coup and removing him, but coming in defense and in support of the new transitional government, like the media is calling it, the new leader. And so there's no question that alternative media and independent media that's going to challenge what's happening in Bolivia and cover the massacres that the new coup government and military under the leadership of the new coup government are committing against indigenous protesters are going to be targeted. And the self-declared president, Jeanine Añez, she has targeted Telesur and taking Telesur off of the airwaves. And this is really significant because Telesur was launched by progressive and left-wing Latin American governments, specifically started and organized by Hugo Chavez to represent the working class in South America to challenge the corporate media in Latin America that's owned by Latin American oligarchs who are against the progressive ideas of socialism and the left and Hugo Chavez and who tend to want U.S. influence in the region. And so this is a really big deal, because if Telesur is taken off the air, that means Bolivians will be left with these corporate-owned media that's not very different than American mainstream corporate media. And we actually have a journalist on the ground now. We partnered up with a Telesur reporter. Her name is Camila Escalante. She's an excellent reporter for Telesur. We partnered up with her. She's doing reporting for us in Bolivia, live reporting to cover the massacre and the reaction and the mass protests that are taking place against the coup government that our media doesn't seem to be giving any coverage to, or trying to paint them as being violent. You know, whenever the military is throwing tear gas or massacring these people, our media tends to call them clashes instead of what they are, which is massacres and violence conveyed by the military that is trained, by the way, by much of the American military establishment.
This is pretty amazing. I wanted to just go back briefly. The woman, Jeanine Añez, declared herself interim president of Bolivia. And again, this is someone that has a very controversial history of racist comments against Bolivia's indigenous majority. We see similar kind of things happening with Guaido in Venezuela. The Organization of American States has their fingerprints all over this with U.S. backing. This is kind of a return to the pre-Bolivarian revolution days. This is a return to the Reagan-esque policies.
Absolutely. I mean, this woman, Jeanine Añez, she's part of the right-wing Democrat Social Movement Party, and they only received 4% of the vote. 4% of the vote. And Washington is basically applauding her transition into the presidency. And so we are witnessing Bolivia heading back into that direction where they're really standing up. The people have to rise up against an imperialist agenda in the region. And you mentioned Guaido. I don't think many people know that right after the coup took place in Bolivia, Washington attempted to overthrow Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela, and that went unreported in the mainstream media. But Washington's like on this reign of terror across Latin America. We don't know what's going to happen next, but what we're seeing in Latin America is this wave, this uprising that's taking place against neoliberalism in countries like Chile and Ecuador and Colombia. And so the sentiment is clear that the masses are not okay with these economic policies. They're not okay with Western imperialism and influence. They want their countries to be free of the shackles of imperialism. But Washington is not letting go, and they're not backing down, and they're just making their attempts even stronger and more aggressive. And that means the people just need to stay stronger and more united than ever in this cause against imperialism.
Of course, there's a serious streak of racism and classism that's involved with imperialism, and particularly as it relates to Central and South America. In nearby Brazil, the right-wing leader Bolsonaro has been quoted as saying about the indigenous peoples there that this is a quote from about 20 years ago, so it shows that this person didn't just cultivate these kind of ideologies as a fad, but it's been a lifelong mission, basically to eradicate indigenous peoples of the Amazon in a way, and he basically alluded to the way that the United States eliminated the Native Americans in North America.
The establishment is extremely intimidated by the indigenous people of these lands, because part of the indigenous culture is to respect the land, mm-hmm. is to respect the land, to be a part of the land, and to be very community-oriented, and to share, and to value family, and those kinds of things. That goes 100% against what the oligarchic establishment wants for these nations. They want to break up society. They want to ravage the land of these resources. They want to take up the water, privatize the industries, and leave these people to be what neoliberalism is, to work so hard with their sweat and tears while the billionaire class are profiting off of their sweat and tears. And that's why these people are a threat to the establishment, because they represent a working class type of ideology that represents peace, that represents non-interventionism. And if you look at Jeanine Añez, she's basically just a woman blonde version of Juan Guaido in Venezuela. It's the same ideology.
People, I think, really need to be much, much more alert and aware of how they're using media, how they're using social media, and how it uses them. And so, Manar, I know that you have written at length about this, but could you talk about how you would suggest that people defend themselves against these mass disinformation campaigns?
The first and foremost thing is we have to decolonize our mind from the two-party system. When we look at the coverage that's coming out with the impeachments, for example, Democrats are giving us this illusion that they are the peace leftist party when they're just another extreme version of politicians that we have. So we have to decolonize our minds from the two-party system and know that we can't get our news from anything related to the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. And that's most of our corporate media and social media platforms, like we just talked about, they're going to be in line with either of those two parties. So we have to decolonize our mind from that thought. The second thing is we have to unite on a ideological basis of peace and freedom of press, freedom of speech. We have to find our common ground with other people in this country. The media works so hard to divide us. These people are this way or that way. We have to find our common ground and what's really, really important for us as a people to survive and to have our voices heard. And then lastly, we have to organize together from a grassroots standpoint. We have to be critical thinkers. And part of that is we have to recognize our strength as the people. There are more of us than there are of them. And so if we unite and get together and organize together, then we can come up with better ways in overcoming a lot of the censorship. What I've done is I got on my soapbox and I spoke up and I've been extremely loud and clear about that this is an issue that's important to me, and I think more people just need to do it. They cannot be afraid.
Well, Manarma Hawash, we certainly appreciate the work that you do at Mint Press News and the people that you work with. Again, mintpressnews.com is the website. I've been speaking with founder, journalist Manarma Hawash, about an article that she wrote around an interview that's an update on social media kinds of censorship. And social media censorship reaches new heights as Twitter permanently bans dissent is the name of the article in her interview with Daniel McAdams. Manarma Hawash, thank you so much for rejoining us on the Project Censored Show. I am very sure that we'll be hearing from you again in the future.
Thank you so much for having me.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain, but my people getting tired of the pain and the shame.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. I am the executive producer of the program. Anthony Fest is our senior producer. The associate producer is Dennis Murphy. The Project Censored Show airs on close to 50 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. To learn more about our work or to find any of our previous archive programs, go to projectcensored.org. Thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
About criminal minds, political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the ties for the master thief. Combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu.